This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the sweetest podcast in the business. My name is Matt Wolf, and I'll be your host. Our topic for this episode is melding themes and mechanisms. And with me tonight are two designers who have wrestled with the beast of melding themes and mechanisms. First up is Victoria Earle. Hey, Victoria.
Hello.
How are you this fine time that we are recording this, which I won't mention. We'll make people wonder when we record.
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am very, very well. And our other guest is Falcon Arendelle. Hey, Falcon.
Howdy.
And that is...
I am also doing well.
Well, I wasn't going to ask you.
Okay.
Yeah. But for listeners, that is Falcon's real name. That is not a nickname.
That is indeed my real name.
All right. Now, before we get to our main topic, first we're going to do our designer discovery segment, where we're going to learn a little bit more about our guest designers. Let's get to that right now. So, Victoria, we're going to start with you. First question is, why did you start designing tabletop games?
Well, like a lot of the GDonk members, I come from video games. I was doing video game design as a hobby for several years, and I had hit a point where I was frustrated with how long it took to prototype games, and I had recently taken up tabletop gaming as a hobby, and I saw that you could make it really quickly, get it play tested, and it wasn't a span of months before you got your design out and tested.
Yeah, that is definitely a common refrain among some group members. How about you, Falcon? Why did you start designing tabletop games?
Well, I got back into tabletop games recently, and it seems whatever I do, I feel the need to create as well as participate. So once I got into gaming, I had to also create. So there I am.
I think that's another, you know, common thread with a lot of designers, that they have that creative drive. And so when they pick up a hobby, they like to see the creative aspect too. How long have you been designing tabletop games?
Well, if we want to go way back, when I used to play role-playing games, I used to design role-playing games. That was a completely different beast. That was back, probably 25 or 30 years ago. Started out doing that really young. And one of those games is still around. Online, I hear every once in a while, "Oh yeah, we played your game the other night." As far as tabletop board games, that's been recent in the last 2 or 3 years.
Falcon, were you designing RPGs professionally?
No, I've never done any of my hobbies professionally that I've been creating. I just created a few when I was younger, and one of them kind of had a little bit of a cult following.
Oh, that's cool.
So why don't you have an entry on RPG Geek for it?
It's not officially published. There's not actually officially written rules. And one of my main things is I could never find someone to do the art that I really wanted to have for it. It involved anthropomorphic inanimate objects, mostly, and I was looking for the right artist and never quite got there. I still sometimes think I ought to write that down and have the official version out there.
It's never too late, that's for sure. Victoria, same question for you. How long have you been designing tabletop games?
When did I join this group? Because that was my first tabletop game design.
About 2 years then.
I didn't mention it before, but I mean, you were a large part of the reason that I started actually designing tabletop games. I had thought about it on and off, but then you pestered me into coming to one of the meetings, and I brought a prototype because I felt like I should.
It's been a while, obviously. It's been like 2 years, but I remember that you were talking and you had some interest, and so it was just a matter of, you know, you finding the time to make it out and potentially maybe also overcoming, you know, a little anxiety of meeting a new group and, you know, presenting your creative ideas in front of people and all that. And that's always a little scary.
Yeah.
All right. So, Victoria, you have experience designing video games. How about any other mediums other than video games?
Not really traditionally creative mediums. I do systems design of a sort. I've been working in conventions for a very long time, and I run the registration department for a large medium-sized video game convention And a lot of that is looking at how does the system work, where is it broken, and how can I fix it? And that's not got a whole lot of similarities with tabletop because there's no multiplayer component, but there is a lot of anticipating problems and problem solving. Also, software design as part of that.
Remind me again, what's the name of that convention that you do work for?
It's MAGFest, the Music and Video Gaming Festival.
And so, Falcon, other than RPGs, do you have any experience designing games in any other mediums?
My first response was no, but then I just realized, I guess I used to do improvisational comedy, and what we used to call the scenes we used to do were games. And we would come up with different formats that the scenes would take place in. So I designed a few of those games. I guess that would count.
Yeah, I think so. Improv is totally, I mean, it's got a rule structure. Even though it's improv, it's right. There's still a rule structure. And usually you have a beginning and an end. And at least if it's good improv, you'll have a beginning and an end. You're not just the guy that carries the toy gun in your back pocket to make sure you always have an out when you're, it's in a scene. That's a pretty interesting one. So Falcon, when you started designing tabletop games, what surprised you the most about your experience?
The thing that surprised me was how difficult it was to find people to play test games. I love playtesting games. You know, people would come into a game group and say, I've designed this game. I'd be like, let's put it on the table and see what it's like. But when I would bring a game to my group, they would not quite make eye contact with you and say, well, that's very interesting. Next. When I was doing RPGs, I didn't realize it at the time, but I had a group that was very adventurous and loved to, you know, experiment. So that was a great growing experience there. I was surprised not to find that in the current group of gamers I was with.
Well, I think that might partly just be a difference between people who play role-playing games and people who are attracted more to tabletop, because role-playing is inherently not only improvisational, which is why I don't do it because I'm really terrible at that, but also extremely creative and requires a lot of the player making the game, and it's not just a set of rules that you play inside.
Right. I definitely
and
see
of
that.
Course, now, you know, you have a group that you can take designs to. And,
I do.
Yeah, so that shouldn't be a problem anymore, let's hope. Yeah. How about you, Victoria? What surprised you the most about designing tabletop games?
How many people were doing it, I think. Coming from the video game hobbyist world, like, it's not a surprise that a lot of people try to make their own video games because they see, you know, Mario, and they're like, oh man, I could do that.
No, they can't.
But, you know, tabletop games is a smaller community compared to video games, and I did not expect so many people to be so gung-ho about designing their own.
All right. So now the flip side of this question. So Victoria, what was just as you expected it to be?
So many things about the way people behave when they're first designing a creative product. I think I'm starting to theorize that it's just the same in any industry. If you are first starting out and you're making something creative and you haven't done it before, you have all the same insecurities. Will someone steal my idea? And all the same kind of behavior, like, oh, I see this really cool thing that's really complex. Let me copy it. Let me just take every mechanic that I like and shove it into one game. And in terms of being kind of parallel to the hobbyist video game creation community, it's very, very similar.
How about you, Falcon? What was just as you expected it to be?
Well, I figured that there would be a lot of math involved, and the ones that I have done so far involved math. I knew that I would have the most difficult time actually writing rules because... frankly, from my RPG days, I knew that that was going to be a bear. Overall, I guess it was pretty much the way I anticipated it on many levels. One thing that I didn't anticipate was how fluid a game could become once you first created it. I didn't anticipate it being so open to change from iteration to iteration.
Yeah, I think that was probably something that surprised me a little bit, too. I mean, you could have a small tweak that would have drastic changes. You could have a lot of big changes that maybe not wouldn't have much difference at all. But yeah, you could have a lot of elasticity between iterations in a design. All right, the last question is, and Falcon, we'll start with you. What piece of advice would you give to a new designer? And no fair for repeating anything that anyone has said before.
Oh, man.
What is this, Jinx?
It could be.
Well, my big thing would be to say, find a group of people that you trust and who you can put your design in front of. I think that is a huge, huge thing. As I was just saying, I was surprised at how difficult that was. And I was very fortunate to have a group like this who were easily accessible.
Yeah, I 100% agree, and not just because it's self-serving, but I've been harping on this for years now. I think your creativity goes up almost immeasurably when you have a group that you can meet with and just bounce ideas off of or play test or anything like that. Victoria, how about you? Same question. What piece of advice would you give to a new designer?
What I was originally going to say is way too close to what Falcon said. So instead, I'm going to play off of what he said and say that finding that group, you want to not just find people who are welcoming, which is, you know, is important, but you want to find people who aren't just welcoming, right? And I think we've discussed this a little bit in the podcast before, but people who will actually challenge you and people who won't just give you a pat on the back and be like, well, you're an unbelievably complex game with 15 different kinds of mechanics. You're doing good. That's good. So you definitely want to find people who will say to you, you know, I don't think this game is working.
Yeah, that's very true. And that's a tough thing, right? Like when you are trying to get feedback and you're trying to give feedback and, you know, you're trying to be honest, but you're also trying to not hurt anyone's feelings. And yeah, it's really important that you have people that can give you honest feedback without, you know, being, how would I put it? Like negative Nancy's, you know, essentially, you know, like, yeah, give me the...
Knowing when to stop.
Yeah, you know, give me the honest truth without, you know, ripping out my heart and stomping on it, I suppose, yeah.
That actually happened to me while I was trying to design a new game while my prototype was up in Virginia. Daniel and Cameron were giving feedback on it, and essentially it just didn't work on many, many, many levels. And at some point during their feedback, I'm like, okay, I need to just start over on this. And Daniel turns to me and he's like, I think we've given Victoria enough. And I'm like, yes, you have. And I crumpled up the rules. And I think that worried them. I think they thought that I might be upset. No, I was very glad to know, like, at that stage, with only two or three playtests, like, this is the time to start over, not 6 months into it, after, you know, months of denial that the game just isn't working as it is.
What was that, your Junkyard Racing deck builder? Is that what it was? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the theme, so hopefully keep that around.
I've got bad news.
No. You can always revive it in something, and that's fine. All right, very good. So now we're going to transition into our main topic, which is melding themes and mechanisms. So this topic was actually suggested by Falcon, and so you can blame Falcon for whatever discussion we're going about to have.
Indeed. Although when I said it, I was kind of anticipating other people talking about it.
No, we're just going to listen to you expound for the next 30 to 45 minutes lecture, our new lecture series here on the podcast. So the first thing I want to do, I want to make sure that we define theme, because theme can mean different things to different people. So Falcon, when you say theme, what do you mean by theme?
When I say theme, I'm thinking more the story of the game, the background, what the art is representing. I was reading online what other people were mentioning, well, the things you might mean by theme. I think that's pretty interesting and something I would be interested in talking or thinking about. But what I had originally thought was just story, whether it's your medieval farmers or, you know, your medieval farmers with sheep or whatever theme is in the background.
Yeah, so kind of like the setting of the game is what you're thinking of. Victoria, is that what you think of when you think of theme?
Pretty much. I would actually call it the real world metaphor that you use to describe what you're doing in the game.
That sounds far too technical.
But I mean, like, instead of
academic.
Yeah, academic, yeah.
No, but like in reality, you're putting little meeple cubes on spots on a board. But in terms of the theme, you are telling your Stone Age cavemen to go gather wood. And so when people like put their meeples on it, you can tell when a game has a strong theme that matches its mechanics, because they'll do an action and they'll describe something they're not actually doing. they'll say, I'm going to go gather wood. But they're not gathering wood. They're not going out into the forest and chopping a tree down. They're putting meeples on a board.
I think I'd quibble just slightly when you say real world metaphor, simply because, I mean, some themes don't exist in the real world. But I get what you're saying, yeah. And yeah, that I think that makes a lot of sense. So for the purposes of this discussion, then we're saying theme is like the setting or the metaphor in which the game is happening. Okay, so that's good. The other, I want to say theme, but I need another word. Like the other thing that's the theme can apply to is more like the feeling of the game, like. Is it a cooperative game? Is it a sharing game? Do I want a backstabbing game? Things like that. And so that would be more like the motif or the of the game. So that's not what we're going to talk about on this episode, just for people who are listening. We're gonna focus on, I guess, more the more traditional, like the setting of the game. Okay, so the next question then is, and Falcon, we're going to start with you again because this was your words. What you said you wanted to discuss top-down and bottom-up design. So what do you mean by top-down and bottom-up?
I think when I'm approaching a game, and I see other people approaching games, sometimes I have a theme in mind and I try to find mechanics to match it. If I'm trying to think of, I want a game about a space station and... So I think of things that have to do with a space station and think of how I might find game elements that I would want within that. But bottom up would be, this is a really interesting mechanic and I've come up with, and I need to kind of find some kind of theme that matches with it and make these things mean something. A real world interface. And that's what I mean by top down or bottom up.
Okay, so top-down would be synonymous with starting with a theme. Bottom-up would be synonymous with starting with a mechanism. Is that accurate?
Overall, yes.
Okay, yeah. I think that framework is, once again, I think traditionally where a lot of designers kind of start. You know, they start with a theme, start with a mechanism. There's lots of ways that you can start, of course. You can start with components. You could start with a theme and a mechanism at the same time. But I think for discussion, top-down and bottom-up is kind of a good framework. Had you heard those terms before, Victoria?
No, I'm really glad Falcon explained them and you didn't ask me because I had no idea.
All right. Before we start talking about theme, can you give me an example of a game that you felt did, you know, just a really excellent job melding theme and mechanism? So, Victoria, do you have something in mind?
Well, besides Stone Age, which I already alluded to, really one of my favorites is Takenoko. And that's partly biased because I think the theme itself lends the game to what I usually use board games for, which is to sucker my friends into playing with me. But non-board gaming friends, I mean. So when I tell them it's a panda game, they're like, okay, I will play a panda game. But also what you do in the game works very well with what the game is about. So in terms of theme, even the weather die makes each one of those generally make sense. There's a couple of little quibbles, and you can see that they're quibbles because new players will often forget what they do. But in general, the game like really matches every mechanism to something that's thematic.
I hadn't really considered Takenoko. I can see that as long as you can bridge the divide of the level of abstraction in it, you know, with hexes. How about you, Falcon? Do you have an example of something you feel just did a really excellent job melding theme and mechanisms?
Recently, I've been playing Kanban, which is a car-making game. But really, it's not about making cars. It's about sucking up to the boss. And I think you really feel like you're doing things to appease the imaginary boss. And the boss is an actual piece in the game. And it's a different game whether she's in a good mood or a bad mood. So I was amazed I would feel like I was trying to appease the boss.
Yeah, I've only played Kanban once. I enjoyed it. I'd like to play again sometime. But you're right. You really do feel like... Okay, you know, Sandra is walking the plant floor where we're, designing cars or building cars. And, you know, at the end of the week, she's going to, you know, give us a performance review, essentially. And, yeah, you kind of feel like, wow, I really need to make sure that I'm working hard so my boss doesn't, you know, yell at me too much during the meeting at the end of the week. I think that's a really good one from like a Euro perspective. Like it's total Euro, right? You know, there's Right. I can't think of if there was any output randomness in that game. Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything. And so, yeah, you know, you have a Euro that has a really well-coupled theme. I'll quibble slightly with the where you put the cubes in for car parts to spit out another car. It's a little weird where I'm only contributing a part and it turns into a car. But that's not so bad.
Well, and that's why I was saying it's not a game about making cars. It's a game about making the boss happy. And that's the theme I felt it did really well.
If you can look at it with that lens, I would definitely agree with that. Two examples that I thought of that I thought just really did a nice job. One was Triassic Terror, which, Victoria, I know you've played. Falcon, have you played that one?
I have not.
And so it's a area control game where you have a herd of dinosaurs, and you're trying to migrate from environment to environment to try to build up your herd and basically to survive. And I think it does a really nice job of kind of having that feel of, wow, you know, I'm entering a new harsh environment and that's going to decimate my herd, but I need to move into there in order to, you know, try to rebuild my herd and spread and, you know, become the dominant herd in the game. And that's a total Euro. Once again, very little randomness in it. And yeah, I think it does a really nice job of having that theme really shine through the mechanisms. And the other one is Snow Tales. Have either of you played Snow Tales?
No.
I've watched it played.
Well, close enough then. Snow Tales is a dog racing game. So it's a race game where you are, yeah, you have your dog sled with two dogs and you're racing down a track. The track is customizable. And it really feels to me like, obviously, I've never gone dog, you know, sledding. I've never been in the Iditarod and really have no desire to because that's really cold. And I moved from the Northeast down to North Carolina to avoid cold as much as possible. So, yeah, that doesn't really interest me. But from what I would imagine that dog sledding is like, it feels like, yeah, that's... You actually will drift a little bit. If one dog is pulling more than the other one because of the cards you play, it's going to move you in that direction. Yeah, I think it does a really nice job of kind of capturing that theme, or at least the theme as I would imagine it in my head. You know, a person that actually does that for a living or has done it at all, they might scoff at the game and be like, no, that's not true at all. But at least for the abstraction that, you know, I think most gamers would have, it seems like it works pretty well.
Honestly, talking about like every game, almost every game we've mentioned something that it doesn't do well for theme, melding theme and mechanism. I think you'd be hard pressed to find a game that doesn't make a compromise at some point in the theme. And usually that's because the thematic rule would not be fun or be broken in some other way.
Yeah, I think that's true. To have like 100% harmony with theme and mechanisms is super, super difficult. And I wouldn't say impossible, because I think that's probably ridiculous to say.
If you have a simple enough games, you know, that gets easier.
Yeah, and if you're modeling something simple, I suppose, yeah. I would throw out something that obviously I'm going to be super biased here, but I think that Wombat Rescue does a really good job of having the theme and the mechanics in the game work very well together. And we'll talk about that when we get to further questions.
You know, the thing with the dingo not hurting anybody, that takes me out of it. Not as realistic as I might want.
See, you can always find a nitpick.
When you play Falcon, you can do it's where he'll just eat, you know, babies and then...
I'm waiting for my copy so I can implement my alternate rules.
Well, I see you posted in the variants forum on BGG. Yeah, no, that is true. And there's a very good reason for that. The last question before we really dig in is, do you personally, when you are starting a new design, do you start with theme, mechanisms, or something else? And if it's both, like if you can assign maybe a percentage to the way that you swing. So Victoria, I'll start with you.
Normally I start with like what I want you to be doing in the sense that, you know, what you'd be doing in the real world, right? So, you know, in the case of Sweet Success, it's like you're making recipes and you're putting them together and stuff comes out. So that's theme, but not in the sense like I want a bakery to be involved. I go much more specific than that, so it's a lot closer to being both a theme and a mechanic. There are definitely times, rarely, when I have a mechanic that I really like, and before I develop it at all, I try to think of a theme that would fit it. Because for me, theme guides how the mechanism goes. And if I don't have a theme, there's just a million options, and I have no idea which way to go, and it's overwhelming. So I definitely go with theme really, really early.
Now, when you come up with a mechanism and you're looking for a theme, do you try to find something that you feel is like a really good fit, or do you just go with the first thing you think of just to give you a framework?
I try to pick something that is a pretty good fit for the core mechanic, although I don't always succeed, and that's actually the problem that I had with the Junker Racing, is that it did not work with the core mechanic as much as I thought it did. That's why I'm scrapping it as a theme. Sorry.
No pun intended there with scrapping.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, I do that all the time.
That's okay. How about you, Falcon? Do you usually start with theme mechanisms? And if either, what kind of percentage do you assign to them?
I do both, but I find that I do better if I have a mechanic and find a theme that matches it. Although there are plenty of themes that I feel that there are mechanics for, and I know once I find those mechanics, I want to plug those into those themes. So I have those on the back burner all the time, but none of the mechanics I come up with ever seem to fit into those games.
Isn't that just frustrating when that happens? Like, oh, I think this will work, and nope, that doesn't work at all. I know for me, I almost always start with theme, and when I start with a mechanism, it's always a poorer design than when I start with a theme. So for the way that I design, it just works out that starting from theme and finding mechanisms that work with that theme works better for me. All right, so now getting into the nitty-gritty, perhaps. So how do you know when a theme does not meld with the mechanism? So let's start with you, Falcon.
That I think I am still trying to figure out. Like I said, I thought maybe somebody else might have these discussions and I could go, ooh, that's a good idea. And that was one of the things I was surprised. I had a game that was about being virtuous. And every time that you tried to be virtuous, you had these temptations. But then I got that the theme didn't work. The mechanic actually worked. It became something else, and then it became something else, and I went through, like, several themes, and right now it's more of a surreal, has some art for it. I don't know. I'm not even working on that one right now. That one has been through too many themes, and I'm not even sure I have the right one still. Others, I had a mechanic, and I was doing the mechanic, and I was like, oh, okay, this is a good mechanic. I'm liking how this moves and how this works, and what am I going to put on it? And the theme just popped to mind, and I did the thing in an afternoon, and I still like the pairing of the theme and the mechanics. So I think you need to be open, you have to try different things, and I think it's going to click eventually, and you'll know when you get the right one.
So you said that you had a design that had a virtuous theme, and then you realized that that theme just wasn't working for the mechanisms. What made it crystallize in your mind that it wasn't working?
I know I can't put my finger on what I didn't like about it. The theme felt too light for the mechanic. The mechanic felt like working really hard. You had to work really hard the way the mechanic was set up, but the theme in my head was kind of cartoony and light, so I felt like it was not a good melding of theme and mechanic. So I felt like I needed something where you needed to work harder. And the book I was reading was just, you were reading it and wondering, how will these people ever achieve their goals? And that's the kind of feeling that I wanted to have in the game when I finally got it to the table. That was why I was trying to find the theme to match that. And it's why I was interested in motif rather than theme. When I playtested this game one time, one of the playtesters asked, what are we supposed to feel when we're playing this game? And I said, despair. And they agreed that that's what they were feeling. They felt that they had to work hard there.
Okay, so Victoria, how do you know when a theme does not meld with a mechanism?
There's a lot of signs. Falcon's point is very good in that, you know, theme does communicate the weight of the game a lot. You know, you don't want to pick up a game about, like, with a little cute cartoon sheep and about how you're a little sheep trying to get from point A to point B and find it takes 3 hours, right? Like, So that's an important point. And I think that's something you can see just as a designer. You can see right away, okay, my game is taking 2.5 hours, but my theme is clearly very light. Other things, your playtesters getting confused, your playtesters not doing what you want them to, which is something that happened with Sweet Success, is that I was calling it, and this isn't 100% theme in the traditional sense, but I was calling it a semi-co-op game and no one was playing it as a semi-co-op game, which was very frustrating. Or more accurately, no one was playing it the way I wanted them to. And finally, at the last meeting, Daniel and I were talking about that and about, like, this is the thing that Drew did, is he paired up with Daniel to get at another player.
Josh, right?
Josh, yes, thank you. Drew, like, cooperated with Daniel to get at Josh, and that's what I wanted people to do, and they almost never did that. So we talked a little about why that was, and it was because I was calling it a semi-co-op game and not, like, an Allegiance game or anything else. So that was the motif. I was explaining the motif incorrectly, and some of the mechanics were based on the semi-co-op idea, and they were discouraging, you know, the things I wanted players to do. But especially players will tell you, they'll be like, what? Especially like specific mechanics, if those are broken, they'll be like, why am I doing this? I am a farmer. Why am I, you know, not irrigating my crops or something like that? They'll be able to tell, because you can tell in published games, especially when you're teaching new players, they'll forget rules that don't work with the theme, or they'll get them wrong. They'll misremember them because they'll remember a more thematic version of them. As for the game overall, like, when you have to scrap a theme, for me, that's, like, when the core mechanic is not working with it. When you have, like, a mechanic you are not willing to give up, and one of the above options, you know, someone saying, like, I don't know why I would do this, or someone not understanding the rules of how you would do it, or someone not playing the way you want them to play, then that's when the game itself is not working with the theme, and when you should scrap it.
I think you do notice that in a lot of published games where people will, you know, forget like a little niggly rule, or they just consistently do something, you know, that they feel like they should be doing, but they're not allowed to. And that does seem like a disconnect between the theme of the game and the mechanisms in the game. I guess when you're playtesting something, you just have to be real careful to make sure that it's not a UX issue in the game. You know, because it's, you know, if you're at the stage where someone is, you know, you wrote it down on index cards and, you know, you just came up with it yesterday and you're just throwing it out there to see if it works. You know, if someone's forgetting to do something, that may not be a theme mechanism disconnect. That might just be, you know, I can't read your handwriting, you know.
There are a lot of reasons that people have trouble remembering rules. And certainly during prototyping, it's difficult to suss out which thing it is.
Right. If they are having trouble remembering, that could be a reason, is because the theme and the mechanism just aren't quite harmonizing at that point. Is there any difference between knowing when a theme doesn't work with a mechanism and when a mechanism doesn't work with a theme? Is that equivalent?
Yeah, I think that's about which you want to keep. So, you know, which are you going to change? Are you going to change the theme to match the mechanism, or the mechanism to match the theme? Though in some cases, like in my case, I was trying to change the mechanism for months and it wasn't working. So in that case, I did have to change the motif itself to get players to do what I wanted. So there are probably cases where you either make a completely new game because that's how broken the mechanism would be, or you fix the theme. There are probably cases where the theme is easier to fix or the mechanism is easier to fix.
How about you, Falcon? Do those feel like an equivalent kind of situation?
I do think that there's a difference there. When I try to find a theme for a mechanic, I'll throw out themes regularly sometimes. Whereas there are a few themes, like I said, that I have on the back burner that I really want to find the right mechanics for. Those are the ones that I'm keeping around. Those are the ones that I have a special place for.
For a theme that you like, what's an example of one that you like, Falcon?
I have a heist game I want to do. I've never played a game where I felt it was a good heist game. And I'm sure after this, people will tell me, oh, you need to be playing this, and I'll find one, and I'll get rid of this idea. But it's something that I want as a semi-co-op, where you're a group of thieves pulling off a heist, but you also have your own selfish interests at heart, which is the way thieves are.
You should consider making it a Shifting Allegiances game, is my advice.
No, mine is actually semi-co-op.
about that. I know what you're saying, though.
This is slightly off topic. I'm really not sure. My version of semi-co-op was, you know, one player can win, but everybody loses. And I think there's a certain kind of player that will not accept that, period, full stop. They won't.
Oh, sure.
Agree to that. And you can either, I almost did this, you can either say, well, too bad, that's not my market. And I had a market outside of that because the theme of my game was a little lighter and the playtime is pretty short, but I preferred to solve it for so that everybody was happy and agreed to the context of the game.
Right. The kind of game that I'm looking for, I don't know if you've played Dead of Winter, where it's kind of a co-op but not a co-op. Any number of people can actually win in the game. You have to work together because all of you can lose, but you also have your own individual goal, and if you complete your goal and you survive, then you've won the game. Other people can do that as well, and it's really good.
So Falcon, for your heist theme that you have, when you're trying to come up with mechanisms for it, what's your process?
Well, I don't actually work toward making up the mechanisms for it specific. When I am working toward coming up with mechanisms, I'm in that mode and thinking how games work and what I'd like to see in a game. I find little pieces here and there, and then I'll take those little pieces and hold them up to the themes that I have on the back burner. Can I put that in there? Can I put that in here? And sometimes I'll find that and I'll have that little element. Let's save that. Maybe I can find a way to work another element together with that so they have a nice synergy to them. Very rarely these days do I look from the top-down method where I'm just trying to find the mechanism and force them in there. May go back to that because I'm getting better at taking things out of games. A lot of times when I did the top-down method, I felt I have to address this, and I gotta address that, and I have to address this, and it becomes way too complicated. And if I can take my beloved idea and say, okay, I really don't need this in there or that in there, I feel I could just get that core going, maybe I could get that game to the table.
How about you, Victoria? Do you have a theme that's kind of like on the back burner that you'd like to design a game for?
Yeah, I have a plushie factory owning game.
A plushie factory?
Yeah.
That would be unique.
Based on a video game I played when I was a little kid, which was like this management game. It wasn't that great, but I loved the theme because it's unique. Probably be an engine building game, I'm thinking. And in fact, I have somewhere a brief write-up of like some rules I thought up a long time ago. I appear not to be able to work on more than one game at a time, so it's been on the back burner.
So what's your process when you have an idea for a theme and you're trying to find mechanisms to fit it?
I don't have one. I generally think of them both kind of, because I'm thinking, you know, I'm not thinking, well, plushies. I'm thinking like, okay, you're a plushie factory owner, and I want you to be taking the parts and putting them together. And the mechanics after that are actually pretty easy. You know, you have different cards for the parts, and you're going to be, you know, building it up, and you'll build up, you know, the ability to create parts and that sort of thing. And so from what you're doing, I try to think of, like, what mechanic will physically work with that? So I try to think of the mechanic kind of on the fly, like, what will fit, you know, this kind of metaphor action.
So you're trying to put yourself in the place of whatever your theme is, and you're trying to see what logically makes sense with that theme, and then find a mechanism that, yeah, that would make sense. So like, so for the plushie factory, yeah, if you're trying to put together a plushie, you would need, like, I don't know what, like an arm card or a foot card or whatever, and you'd have to assemble those things, and there's your plushie. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, very similar. I was actually thinking like stuffing, and then
okay,
you know, skin type has to be called something less creepy than that, but
fabric or something.
Fabric. And you know, I had ideas for like maybe there's different styles that are going to be in season at different times, and you're trying to make the most profitable kind of, you know, plush animal for that season and predict the market. So you know, from all that, you know, I think of like what other games have done something like this. Right? Like, if you're trying to predict the market, well, I've definitely played a game where you have a market tracker and you move it up and down depending on a die roll. Maybe that'll work well, or maybe some kind of spin on that will work well.
I think we need a reteam of Kanban. That sounds like that would work.
Plushie Bon. When I have a theme, I try to do a lot of research into the theme. and try to do a real deep dive and try to really understand it. So for Wombat Rescue, I read so many things about wombats and how they live their lives and how they operate, and tried to model the mechanisms in the game after what they really do. So for example, the player board in Wombat Rescue, when you eat food, you put the food on your player board and it will digest over several turns. It'll be 4 turns if you don't speed it up. And that came from the fact that wombats actually have a digestive period of 12 to 14 days, which is very long, especially for mammals. And the reason why, at least the reason why we think they have such a long digestive period, is because their digestive tract sucks out more moisture out of the food that they eat, and that's what allows their poop to become cubic shaped and hold that shape. So when I read that, that informed the mechanism that, okay, when you eat food, you're not going to be able to produce a poop cube right away. It's going to take you some turns, and that really led to a lot of strategy in the game of trying to position yourself somewhere where you want to be able to maximize your smell area as best you can. And that was totally just by, yeah, just doing that deep dive into the theme and just seeing what things were there that could be modeled into a game. A similar thing with Demolition Derby dice, which I know Falcon has played. Victoria, I don't believe you have.
Once a long time ago.
It was probably pretty different when you played. I've had 3 different designs now with that theme. This last one is working much better because I finally took my own damn advice and read a lot about demolition derbies. And one of the things I discovered was that in most demolition derbies, you're not allowed to hit the driver's side door because it's dangerous. And so there's penalty cubes on the driver's side door in the current iteration. And so if you hit the driver's side door, you have to take a penalty cube in addition to the cube of the player color, and if you have the most penalty cubes at the end of the round, you're going to lose some points. Makes it a little bit risky and affects your choices of which dice you want to re-roll potentially during the round. And I was just informed by reading about demolition derbies.
Do you still like flick the cars around?
Nope, there are no cars. No, it's a real-time dice rolling game now.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, because that would affect your aim, whereas before you were just trying to hit people, you would, try not to hit their driver's side door.
Right.
But still, it's the same thing, just not dexterity.
Well, I mean, if you consider real-time dexterity, which is a kind of a gray area. Some people do, some people don't.
Dice is the dexterity in that.
Yeah.
Can I throw my dice at other people's dice and change them?
Yes, actually, yes. Okay. You can. Yeah.
And knock them out of the good area too.
Right. Yeah. If you knock them out of the wild space, out of the middle, which you do want to try to do, otherwise, they can set themselves up to, get a big hit on someone. But yeah. So I think if designers are struggling with their theme and with struggling to find mechanisms, I think just reading about that theme and just really doing as deep a dive as you can, it will be helpful to inform what you should be doing. And if you kind of picked a theme that you don't know much about, that may have been a mistake. Can you go read about that, whatever that is, right? It's almost like the advice for authors, like write what you know, right? And so you almost have to design what you know. So if there's a theme that you really like, you need to learn about that theme and then absorb that and let that kind of guide you.
Or make up something that nobody knows, which is the corollary to that writer's advice. So no one can fact check you on it.
That would also work, yeah. I wonder what would happen. Would that make a game harder to learn if you also need to learn everything about that world? Oh, actually, yeah, it would, right? Because Netrunner, that's a game where it's a totally made-up universe that there's sort of analogs for, the real world in terms of, hacking and ice and all that stuff.
Well, and there are analogs for cyberpunk and a certain genre of game, because right. When I first saw it, I thought it was based on a specific book or a specific game, and I was surprised to find out it was actually its own IP. But still, that does present a barrier to entry, anyone who isn't already familiar with how that stuff works,
right? Or even if they are, they still need to learn the nuances of that particular world. So yeah, I guess you could do it, but boy, you need to really, really be careful on how crazy you go there and how difficult that would make it to learn.
Yeah, I think you can get away with it if you make your lore really simple.
Yeah.
Right? If you just make the simplest, Netrunner is, got its own, as a world, it's really cool, but, there's a lot to it. Whereas if you just made up like this really simple model of a new fantasy world or sci-fi world that your players could learn really quickly, then it wouldn't be as big a deal.
Both of you have said that if you find the theme that you're working with is not working with the mechanisms that you have in the game, and if you like the mechanisms, you like to try to throw the theme out and try to find another theme. So at what point do you make that theme switch? Do you do it almost like immediately when you realize it's not working, or do you let the theme kind of linger a little bit just to see if you can learn anything more about that design? So Victoria, how about you first?
I have done both. Not a lot of people in the group know this, but I came very close to completely retheming Sweet Success because of how much it was not working, and I thought maybe changing the theme a little would help players understand the game better. And I let it sit because it had been a while. I had been playtesting it for quite a long time at that point, and I guess I just didn't feel that it was super necessary, and I kind of probably knew that I was just grasping at straws, basically. But then in Junker Racing, it was really obvious. It was so obvious that it wasn't working at all, and so I just threw it out immediately. So I guess it depends on where the game is in development. You know, if it's been a while and the theme has been mostly working, then maybe that's not the problem. But if it's a new prototype and nobody's getting how the theme melds with the mechanism, and you are also not getting how the theme melds with the mechanism, then just throw it out and do a new one.
What was the theme that you were thinking about switching Sweet Success to?
House construction. Like room construction, because in terms of the tile, like, you know, orthogonal placement, that would have worked a little better. I did think about it for a long time, and it was a lot of trade-offs. You know, there were a lot of things like, how would you replace pieces of a house? That doesn't make any sense. how would you complete parts of a house, right? And so that's ultimately why I didn't go for it.
How about you, Falcon? Do you tend to remove the theme and switch it up right away as soon as you realize it's not working? Or do you kind of let it sit for a while to see if there's anything else you can learn?
I'm kind of lackadaisical in my designs. I mull a lot. And if I'm not liking something, I'll set it off to the side, put it in the back of my mind. I'm not on any time crunch, so I don't feel that I need to complete anything in a certain amount of time, which I know you said it is very helpful, and perhaps it would be helpful to actually get some of these games out there, but I put it in the back of my brain, and I'll think about it and think about it, and then it'll come to me, and I'll be a whirl of activity for a little bit, and get it to the table and see if anybody salutes.
Yeah, let the wonder of your subconscious mind do its thing and figure it out for you.
I try to sleep a lot.
It's interesting because a lot of people in our group talk about setting designs aside, and I hate that. I refuse to do it if I can at all help it because, first of all, I forget everything. Even if I take a break because, you know, my other life is busy, my work is too busy, I come back to it and I just hate the feeling that I don't quite remember what has gone into it so far and what the recent changes have been and all that. But also, I have a habit of keeping my subconscious busy at all times. So I don't have that thing very often where my subconscious solves a problem that I've set aside because I put it out of my mind. It is gone, and I am working on something else. It's not on the back burner. It's like in a different room. It's in another kitchen. It's in another house. So I tend not to do that.
May I recommend a life of leisure? That will help with that.
I have a problem. I take on way too much stuff all the time. It's really bad.
That's fairly common. A lot of people do that. So what do you think a designer could do to better meld a theme and mechanisms? So Victoria, how about you first?
I don't have terribly good advice for this because my only advice is to keep the theme in mind, like start with the theme sooner and try to build the mechanism on the theme. If you have a mechanism that you already like, it's going to be hard to like attach it to a theme. There's not a lot of glue you can use. Although one thing that did happen during the last meeting was that a mechanic that wasn't working very well, that players didn't understand very well, just because it was worded, it had an exception to it that didn't make a lot of sense to people, but it like was necessary. Josh actually came up with something that fixed the explanation of the mechanic, and it was a physical action that you did. So one thing you could do possibly to like take a mechanic and meld it better with the theme is think of like, how physically are you doing that? are you discarding a card to a pile, or are you giving the card, or are you shuffling it back into the deck, maybe? And depending on what you are physically doing to accomplish that mechanism, that might better tie it to the theme.
So take into account the physicality of player actions in your game and use that as another tool to reinforce theme.
Yeah, but also just start with the theme and let the theme guide you for the mechanics. That's what I do anyway.
How about you, Falcon? What do you think designers can do to better meld theme and mechanisms?
I was thinking of something along the lines of what Victoria was just saying. As far as physicality and how it looks and how you interact with the game can really get you into the game. And that's what you want with the theme. You want them to say that they are doing something that they're not physically doing. Never thought of it that way. Like me saying I'm going to go search this room rather than just moving a piece over to the area to do that thing. You can tell when people are thinking in the theme mode. It's a good fit. And I can see most when they're doing that physically has to do what I can't get this out succinctly. What Victoria said. That's my answer.
I'm sorry.
Cool.
It's a hard question, right? Because I mean, yeah. if this was an easy question, we probably wouldn't even have this discussion. You know, this is something that I think every designer wrestles with.
Well, like we were talking about, or in a previous podcast, they were talking about prototyping and keeping it simple. But sometimes I feel like I need to put that extra piece of art in there for the theme. I need to get that extra piece just the right way so people can interact with it the right way, because I want to see the interaction with the mechanic, and that's why sometimes I go too far with my prototypes.
Like getting a figure 3D printed.
One thing you could also do that my playtesters kind of did for me is, and you have to be careful about this, you have to really limit it, but phrasing certain actions, especially if they're very unique, in like a thematic way. So one of the mechanics I introduced to Sweet Success was the ability to take one of your ingredients and replace someone else's ingredient on the board. And at first I called it clobbering, and immediately everyone in the group would not stop calling it cobblering. And you know you can't put it in the final version of the rules, but it lets them get into it a little bit more. The caveat to that is that if your entire rulebook, like if you could say discard and you say something that is not discard, I don't like you as a player.
Yeah, don't do that.
I'm really mad at you for doing that. Has to be like something that's really unique and a special kind of action that doesn't already have a good word for it.
Right, yeah. I mean, if you're assigning thematic terms to common things, that's a barrier to learning that game. Don't do that. There's a game out there called Cheesonomics, which does that in the rulebook, and it's so difficult to learn, and it's a super simple like set collection game. Had they used theme neutral language for common actions, it would have been a piece of cake to learn. But that rulebook is really frustrating simply because it's written in that manner. So yeah, don't do that, designers.
This reminds me of a completely off-topic thing about rules. I hear a lot about people from this group, Josh and Falcon, saying they don't like writing rules. One of the things, and when you said the rules are really hard to understand, one of the things you can do is you can actually go online to a site called Hemingway Editor. And what it does, you paste your rules in there, and it tells you if your language is too complex. Because one of the biggest problems you'll have is writing something, like a sentence that's just too complicated, and your players are trying to read it, and they're like, I don't understand. The sentence is 3 lines long, and it's just too much to get through. So that's one of the things that'll like highlight the sentences in red and tell you when you're using passive voice and a bunch of other different like really handy stuff. So there's tools like that can help you do a first pass edit before you put it in front of playtesters.
The only advice I would have to better meld theme and mechanisms, we've already kind of talked about it, but you know, do that real deep dive into whatever your theme is. Put yourself in the place of whoever the actor is in the game, whether you the player are the actor in the game or whether you are more omniscient and you are controlling people or things in the game. Really try to put yourself in that situation and analyze what makes sense from that perspective. One thing that I think really throws a theme disconnect is where you have multiple perspectives from the player. I had a design a while back. I think I called it pick and deliver. It was a, guess what, pick up and deliver game. You had 9 cards in front of you that made up like your little individual player board, essentially. And you would draft cards out of a hand and then pass the cards to the next player. One of the cards you would put in your delivery queue, and one of them you would put into your opponent's delivery queue, either on the left or right. And Victoria, you played this a long time ago. You probably don't remember. That's okay. One of the issues with that, with learning that one, was the player had 2 perspectives. They had the perspective of, I'm a delivery truck driver, and this is my work queue, and this is what I need to focus on. And they also had the other perspective of, somehow I'm also this other delivery driver's boss, and I'm giving them an order in their queue.
You're a spy.
I'm a corporate, I'm a trucking spy. Yeah. All right, someone make this game, Trucking Spies. I want to see that. So just that perspective disconnect, that told me right away that, you know, that kind of mechanism just wasn't going to work for what I was trying with that game. And I still need to get back to that, because I still think there's something in the idea of that, but it hasn't been a priority. So I think that's another thing. You know, making sure you have a consistent perspective for whatever actor you are in the game can really help to have a better meld as well.
It helps ground the player in what they're doing.
Right.
Which, again, like I was saying before, you know, that means they know what to say they're doing when they're doing a game action.
You said it earlier in the podcast, like when someone says, you know, they're putting their meeple out there, you know, I'm going to go get some wood, right? It's they are saying, I am going to get some wood. It's not my little dude goes get some wood, right? And so
you do hear people say that as well.
Yeah, they might. Yeah. But they're using, you know, the game language, and that's a really good sign. When is it okay to not worry about matching theme and mechanisms? Let's start with you, Falcon. Or I should say, is it okay?
Oh, yeah. I think there are abstract games out there that really have no theme. I'm sure that it's okay. I've never gravitated in that direction. I always feel that my game needs some sort of theme to it. Hopefully something that will give some indication of what weight the game is. Or I think maybe if I came up with something that was really a pure mental exercise, I would be okay with that being an abstract game. But overall, I think theme helps a lot in the game, and I wouldn't want to shortchange my customers.
Do you feel that there's any other types of games where it's okay not to worry so much about, you know, really trying to get the theme and mechanisms to meld other than pure abstracts?
Oh, you mean maybe having a theme, but it's just...
It's loose, you know, it's like, yeah.
I kind of feel like that's kind of cheating. I'm sure that it's okay. I don't know if I should... Like, I played Viceroy, and the theme means nothing in that game. It's really an abstract game. The cards look nice, and it looks better for having some sort of theme, I guess, but it feels like a cheat to me.
So you feel like you're not as immersed? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Now, did you enjoy playing Viceroy?
I did, but again, it was totally as an abstract kind of game. I wasn't thinking, I'm building a pyramid of power here. I'm trying to match these little circles the best I can, and getting these pieces by putting these cards out there. I never thought of the characters themselves as meaning anything.
I haven't played Viceroy, so but I have heard that critique is that the theme is, you know, who cares? Since it's based on that Russian CCG, so that's where they got the theme from. But yeah, at least from an American audience, it's like, eh, whatever. So how about you, Victoria? Is it okay, and if it is, when is it okay to not worry so much about trying to have a really tight meld between theme and mechanisms?
I definitely think there are cases where that's kind of your best option, is to have a pretty loosely coupled theme. Probably the one I can think of immediately is Love Letter, right? Really simple, kind of micro game. Like, you're not actually courting the princess. You're playing cards against each other. But the theme adds, you know, just a little bit. And without the theme, like, the thing about it is that you could not do anything to that game to make it meld better with the theme without completely changing it as a game. And I think that's the biggest instance where, like, yeah, it makes total sense to put, like, a pretty loosely coupled theme. Because, frankly, abstract games, I don't think of abstract as not a theme. I think of it as its own kind of theme, right? Because just like any other theme, it kind of communicates what the game is like. You know, if you see an abstract game on the store, on the shelf, and you take it down and it's basically Lords of Waterdeep, you're going to be very confused, right? Because you have it's got a lot of real world metaphors that could be applied to it. But, you know, you buy an abstract game and the mechanisms are really unique. And the stuff you do as a player just couldn't possibly tie it into anything. That for me is like what an abstract game communicates, is that like the strategy that you use, usually like a very simple kind of game, like Red 7, I think is probably the perfect game for abstract games, where, you know, it's really simple to learn, but then there's a lot of deep strategy to it.
You think Red 7 is really simple to learn? It's man, you'll get some quibbles there. Maybe it's just the rule book.
In the sense that, like, there's not a whole... There's stages to the game, which is something they did, you know, purposefully to help you get into the game.
Right.
So if you do follow those stages, it's pretty easy to pick up and learn. As far as actually playing it correctly, you're going to have a hard time. But you can still play it. And for that, like, that for me is what an abstract theme communicates. If your game wouldn't work like that, if your game is light enough to be love letter, then an abstract theme isn't going to get you the audience that would enjoy that game, right?
Okay.
And in general, I'm not too picky, right? As long as the theme doesn't actually conflict, as long as there's no, what's that fancy term? Ludonarrative dissonance, as long as there's no, yeah.
Whoa, all right. We've just exceeded our egghead quotient for the podcast here.
That sounded academic again.
Yep.
Yeah. No, it's a video game term where you're, as the player, you're doing things that make no sense in the context of the story. Like your protagonist is supposed to be this loving, kind person, and then you switch out of the cutscene into the gameplay and you kill a bunch of people as part of the gameplay, right? That's what that refers to. So anyway, getting back to board games. As long as the theme doesn't actually create a dissonance with, like, the rules or what you're doing, then I think it's okay if it's loosely coupled. I'm not too picky. I don't really need a theme to get into the game. So that's my standard.
So basically, as long as the mechanisms are strong enough that, you know, you feel they kind of work, even with a loose theme, that would kind of be like your threshold.
Yeah, and I think as long as you make clear that the theme is like a thin over the top of the game, and you don't create the impression that you're actually going to be like put into the role that the game describes, which is again a love letter. You don't have a character. Imagine if love letter like set you up as like you are so and so, the a lonely prince who's trying to woo the princess, and it goes through all of that. That wouldn't make a lot of sense to the game. Hopefully that's not actually in the rule book and I'm just not remembering it, because then I would look really dumb.
I think it does say that, you know, you're a suitor. No. It doesn't give you like a character name or anything.
Right,
but
right.
I think that's it does say, like, you know, you're a suitor of the princess and you're trying to smuggle, you know, your love note through the princess's intermediaries. So yeah, I mean, it's not the strongest of theme, but you know, I can buy it. Yeah. So
yeah,
it's close enough that.
And it's devoted one sentence to the theme. It's
right.
Like, here's the setup. Here's the flavor. It's much more flavor than theme.
Yeah, and I think that touches on a time where I think it's okay to have like a, you know, fairly loose theme, and it's filler game. Like, I think a lot of filler games, because just the short duration, you know, it's okay. If you have something like, oh, I don't know, Six Nimmt or a Bluxen, where there's like maybe one sentence of theme in those games, like you're trying to avoid the bulls in Six Nimmt.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's really what. That's why there's bulls on all the cards. And
I had no idea.
Yeah,
because
it's like totally abstract, right?
Or even Splendor.
Right. Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, Splendor. That's another one. Yeah. I'm gonna. If you look into the illustrations in the three decks of cards, where it's like, okay, I went and found gems in the first deck, and I used those gems to be able to buy better gem mines, or now in the second deck, or I'm taking them to someone who can turn them into better actual, you know, cut gems. And in the third deck, and then you have, once again, you have people that are either buying them, or you have people that can turn them into very nice pieces of jewelry. They don't touch on that in the rule book at all. They just say, you know, you're collecting gems in order to sell to nobles, and that was, or whatever exactly it is. That's pretty much it. But if you look at the illustrations, there actually is a little bit of a story there, and I don't know why they didn't put it into the rule book. Had they put it in the rule book, I think maybe some people would feel that it has a slightly more of a theme than it does. But you're right, Falcon. Essentially, it is fairly abstract with a very, very loose coupled theme.
And I think, now that you guys have been mentioning it, that feels a lot less like cheating in a filler game. In a short, lighter game like that, I don't think the theme is as important.
It's probably a function of duration. At some point, and I don't know what that point would be, whether it's like a half hour or 45 minutes or something, but you probably need to feel like you are really involved in the theme in order to keep going in the game. I can't think of an abstract other than chess, which really isn't necessarily an abstract, depending on how technical you want to be with that term. But I can't think of an abstract that really lasts longer than like 30 to 40 minutes. Like even the like the GIF series, those are going to clock in around 30 minutes, depending on how AP prone players might be. So yeah, it might just be simply a function of duration.
Yeah, because I can't imagine playing a loosely coupled or an abstract theme for like 2 hours.
Right. Yeah. Move this square over there. And yes, I'm the square clan. That is, whatever. That actually might be kind of the rule. Probably, I don't know, around 30 minutes. And when you start pushing beyond that, you better make sure that your theme is pretty, is like the longer it goes, the tighter it's coupled.
I'll agree with that. I'll accept that.
Some takeaways would be, try to do your research, put yourself in the role of the actor in the game that you are designing. What was your fancy academic term you used, Victoria?
Which one?
The most recent one.
Ludonarrative dissonance.
Yeah.
It doesn't 100% apply, I don't think. But
it's pretty close, though. Essentially, that's the game narrative and when it doesn't make sense. Yeah. And so really, really pay attention to when your players and playtesters are just fumbling and try to determine whether that's because, is it a UX issue or is it because the theme just is not melding well with the mechanisms. All right, very good. So now we're going to have some news here. The first piece of news is Kodama, The Tree Spirits by Daniel Solis is still on Kickstarter. It has 2 more weeks to go from this recording. It is just over $57,000, which is awesome. It's doing very, very well on Kickstarter. Really happy to see that. Definitely deserves it. Really beautiful illustrations. Go check it out if you haven't already. Kodama is spelled K-O-D-A-M-A. If you search for that on Kickstarter, it'll pop right up. This is from Action Phase Games, and once again designed by group member Daniel Solis. And the next piece of news is group member Eugene Shenderov has relaunched Comrades and Patriots. At the time of this recording, it has 7 days to go, so when this drops, it'll probably have about 4 or 5 days left. The next piece of news is Josh Mills, James Myers, and myself are all going to be at the Unpub Mini at Battlegrounds in Midlothian, Virginia, which is outside of Richmond, Virginia. That is on Saturday, November 14th. I don't know what games Josh and James will have. I will have Demolition Derby Dice, and I will pretty sure I'm going to have a bunch of other designs too, but Demolition Derby Dice is going to be the one that I'm going to be focusing on. So if you're in the area of Richmond, or if you want to travel a bit like we are, come on out on the 14th. It's going to start at noon, and that store apparently is open until midnight on Saturdays, and they're planning on running the event basically until people go away. So it might go until midnight. We'll find out. So come on out. You can meet Josh, James, and myself. You can tell us how much you hate the podcast. That's fine. But yeah, come on out. Help us improve our games. They will be giving away games. I don't know how many. I don't have too much insight into how it's being run. But I do know that they'll have some game raffles that they will have to give away to playtesters. The next piece of news is group member Mark McGee will be demoing Five Elements at MaceCon also on Saturday, November 14th. Mace is in Charlotte, or at least just outside Charlotte, here in North Carolina. Mark will be demoing Five Elements from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the Lakeshore Room, table L20. I'm assuming there's some type of program for Mace that lists that, or at least the website does. So if you don't remember that, check out the website for Mace, which should have all that information. And group member Graham Allen, coincidentally, and didn't even try to team up with Mark here, but he will also be at Mace and is demoing also on Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the Lakeshore Room, table L3. So they'll be demo buddies during that time. Graham is demoing the Shadow State. Definitely check out the Shadow State and Five Elements. They're both games that are in late stages, but they could still definitely use your feedback for any improvement that you can help with. And that will do it for the news, unless Victoria or Falcon, you guys have anything else to add?
I'm considering going up with you guys to Unpub Mini.
Oh, cool.
If either of you will carpool with me.
We will figure something out.
I said either. There's three people now.
Yeah.
If any of you will carpool.
Falcon, if people want to contact you, where can they get a hold of you?
They can get a hold of me on Twitter. I'm at LO5Games.
All right, Victoria, where can people get a hold of you?
I am also on the Twitters at VM Earl, and BGG is Kitsuta, which is KITSUTA. Nobody knows how to spell or pronounce that. Twitter's better. I'll check BGG once in a while, but Twitter's a lot better to get a hold of me.
And you can contact me on Twitter at Matt Wolf with an E on the end of Wolf, and also the same username on BoardGameGeek. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please join our guild on BGG. Go to podcast.gdofnc.com. That's podcast.gdofnc.com. And that will redirect you to our guild on BoardGameGeek. Subscribe and join in on the conversation that we try to have for each episode. We also have a group Twitter account, which you can follow at gdofnc.com, which of course stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. If you tweet at the account, you may get a snarky response. You may get a nice response. It depends on the time of day and the phase of the moon. You can also subscribe to the podcast using iTunes, Stitcher, or through the RSS feed provided by our podcast host, Buzzsprout. And that will do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Remember to not put meeples up your nose, and we'll see you next time.